Look at you, Virginia, just wanting to get up here. Guess what? It's your time. This is anniversary night, in case you didn't know, hence the cake and everything. And Barbara is going to be celebrating 32 years, and Virginia is going to give her her chip.
You know, I practice every single... My name's Virginia, and I'm an alcoholic. I get excited, and I'm delighted to be here. Every year, I practice what I'm going to say when I give Barbara her chip. But you know what? You can't practice. It's just the same thing. When I first met Barbara, I was frightened of her. When she asked me to sponsor her, I nearly had a heart attack. But I have to tell you, I've never met anybody who is more involved in service or has a gentler heart. And I have a tremendous love for alcoholics, and I see the same thing in Barbara. And I just can't congratulate you enough on 32 years.
Thank you.
I know. People told me I scare them. I don't know why. I'm really a pussycat. But my sobriety date is June the 29th of 1984, and it's never on the Friday night that this group celebrates its anniversary, so I always end up celebrating in the following month. And 1984, there's probably a few people in here that weren't even born then. I need to tell you, if you're here, you're young. I don't care how old you are, but if you're here, please stay here. When I came in, this was the last place in the world I wanted to be. I did not have a desire to quit drinking. I just had a desire to stop hating myself. And what I found out is AA taught me how to do that. And it taught me how to be a friend, taught me how to be a good daughter. It taught me how to be a whole person, which I wasn't before. And my husband came tonight to see me pick up my chip. He's not in the program, but he intuitively knows how to handle situations that used to baffle me. And I want to thank him for being here and putting up with me, because I still have those moments. You know how us alcoholics are. But thank you very much.
Then we have Pete with 27 years, and Jim is going to give him his chip.
Thank you. I'm Jim, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm here tonight. Give this to Pete. You know, Pete told me he got sober in Las Vegas. And, you know, out there, it's a hell of a place to get sober. You know, out there he tells me that he was involved in service. And he also told me that they dedicated a statue to him out there. of Pete reaching down and helping some poor guy in the gutter. I've been to Vegas a number of times. I haven't seen that statue yet.
They took it down?
But I know Pete is such a humble guy that he wouldn't tell me unless that actually was true. You know, I tell you, Pete has got a great sense of humor. I'm blessed to be his sponsor. You know, sometimes we talk to each other in work, on the way to work in the morning, and you know, I really appreciate those times. You know, like Barb and Pete, and I know Pete's wife Colleen. You know, these are people that got years in the program, and they're all very involved in service. I mean, they're all involved with what's coming up with the state convention. They're involved bringing meetings into rehabs, and they have a sponsor, they sponsor people, and they have a home group. So even after all these years, it's nice to see that this simple program still works in a very simple way for us, kind of complicated people. So, Pete, God bless you, my friend. Congratulations.
Pete, I'm an alcoholic. I told Jim I was going to write out something and send it to him, have him read it. July 14th, 1989, I was sitting at the Elephant Bar on Maryland Parkway in Las Vegas, and I was trying to get a buzz going because there's these kids sitting at the end of the bar, and they were having fun. They were college, it was close to UNLV, and it was their college kids having that fun, when it, you know, when it was like that for us. And I was drinking, I was getting nowhere. And I made a mistake of looking behind the bar. With a good bar has a good mirror, and I got that moment of clarity. And I knew it was over. And it was like, you know, I know God didn't talk to me, but I heard, you know, you're done. And I went back to my apartment, fell asleep that night, and I said the most sincere prayer I've ever said in AA. And I got on my knees that morning and said, God, please help me. And I went to the Triangle Club, because I'd been in and out of AA a few times, and I knew where that was at. And I went there, and an old guy, Don was there. And I said, Don, how come I can't get this thing? And he says, you keep coming in like this, you got to come in like this. And then he drew two circles. And one he put AA, and the other he put the world. He says, Pete, I live in the world, I live in AA and go out the world, take care of my business, and get back to AA. He says, that doesn't mean I'm sitting in a meeting 24 hours a day. He says, my mind is of AA matters and the friends and fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got to take care of myself out in the world. He says, you, on the other hand, live in the world, pop into AA, and then go back to the world. And it was true, and it clicked for me. So my point is, if you're here and you're new, don't walk around the pool, jump in. Just jump in, because I did a lot of things wrong except pick up a drink. So, you know, it just blows me away. You know, I was new and seeing these people get time, and it just starts clicking off one day at a time, but it clicks off. And thank all of you.
And we have Esperanza with 8 years, and Suzanne is going to give her her check. I'm Suzanne. I'm definitely an alcoholic.
Yes.
And I stink at this, but this is an honor for me. I love what Pete said about being around AA. Because a lot of us can be around AA. And I saw Esperanza around AA for a long time. I don't know how involved she was or not involved, but I know that we've been working together for a couple months. And in the time that we've worked together, when somebody asked me to sponsor them, one of the things I asked them is, are you willing to go to any length? Because at some point in time, I'm going to ask something of somebody that's really uncomfortable. And then you can go back and go, you know that time we asked about any length? And I have to tell you, this woman has amazed me. She's totally amazed me. And we've walked through a lot of stuff in a couple of months, both of us in our lives. And we've done it together. And that's the amazing thing about being able to walk this journey. And if anybody is struggling with inventory, one thing I want to tell you is sit down with her knee to knee one day. She knows how to do inventory, and I struggled with inventory for a long time in AA, and I still struggle today because I don't want to let go of my stuff. But if you are struggling, sit down with her knee to knee and go through some stuff, and she will help you. She's got it down. So congratulations on 8 years, and let's hear what you have to say.
You know, it took a very long time for me to become a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was in and out of the program for many, many years, and you know, I finally decided to surrender, and that God actually had a better plan than I did, and I would stop playing Him and allow the miracle to work. And through sponsorship and sponsoring others, going to meetings, having service work, I have been able to have a life beyond my wildest dreams. And, you know, the many people that have helped me get the things that I have today. Thank you. And I would like to announce our speaker, Suzanne.
Suzanne, again, is still an alcoholic. Nothing changed in the last 10 minutes.
a couple of you knew I was speaking because I wore a dress. I walked up and Dan said, because I guess I need to start dressing nicer when I come to meetings. I don't know. But my sobriety date is October 10th, 1985, and that was a really long time ago. And you all were really old when I got here, and my life was over. My home group is Progress Not Perfection Group. We meet on Monday mornings at 9:30, and I have a sponsor, and I sponsor women today, and I am grateful for the life I have. And I'm nervous, but I guess that just goes with the territory. So I have so much love for so many of you in here. I moved to this area like 11 years ago, and wow, a lot has happened in 11 years, and I just have a lot of gratitude for the life I have. And I have like 35 minutes to tell you about it. So I found out last week, Esperanza asked me if I would speak, and whenever that happens, I kind of find myself through the week thinking about my story and thinking about things that happened, and I'll tell you like the book says in a general way what happened and what my life is like now. But the flashback I had that stood out to me is I was outside my friend's apartment with a group of people, which was not uncommon, but her husband had decided to beat her in public. So somebody called the police, and at some point in time during this, I had been drinking, obviously. I had her baby in my arms and could not manage the baby and the cigarette I had in my hand, and I burned the crap out of the baby with the cigarette. And it's just one of those moments, and I don't know if any of you guys have had those moments in your drinking where you just want to crawl a little deeper into that hole that's inside you. And she, of course, ran over and said, "What's wrong?" And I'm playing like, "I don't have any idea what's wrong. I don't know what's wrong." And I handed the baby, and we go on about our business. But this was normal to me. This was the life I lived. This is what I stooped to. And never in a million years, I judged myself by my intentions. And unfortunately, the rest of the world judged me by my actions. So I would never hurt a baby. I would never do that. But that's not the woman that I was when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. So 12 and 12 in the beginning, and I'm not good at quoting it, says the 12 steps and 12 traditions are a set of principles, spiritual in their nature, which if practiced as a way of life will enable the sufferer to live happily and usefully whole. And that didn't mean jack squat to me when I first got sober. Because all I wanted was to stop drinking long enough to get out of the mess that I was in. And I knew that if I could just stop drinking and doing everything else that came with that lifestyle, my life would calm down, and then I could probably go back to drinking again or whatever. But I just knew I had to get things fixed, and it was bad. And boy, did I not really understand what it meant to be an alcoholic. I'll share that I come from a family of alcoholics, and I grew up with a family that drank, and my mother drank especially, and I was never going to be like her, and I remember saying I was never going to be like her, and I grew up going to Catholic school, and I just want to share a couple of things that happened to me that formulated my life along the way, and I wish I could share so many, but they're really interesting to me. I don't know about for you, but one of them was when I was in third grade. A very misinformed person who held a lot of power for me, so therefore I believed what they said to be truth, told me, because I got in trouble, that if you even think anything, it's a sin. So in my ripe old age of 9, I probably was, I thought, well, if I think it is a sin, I might as well do it and get some pleasure out of it, because if I'm going to sin, a sin is a sin either way, and if I'm going to hell, I might as well enjoy my ride. So something happened with me already at 9 years old, me and God. We had a bit of a parting because all of a sudden now I have this God that's keeping a set of books waiting for me to screw up one more time. And there's no way that I can ever out good the bad. There's no way. The bad list is getting so big, there's no way that I can ever out good it, if that's proper terminology. So then years later, not many years later, because I was pretty young when I took my first drink, on New Year's Eve, I was with some friends, and we decided to raid their parents' liquor cabinet, and we drank a little bit of everything in there, because you know you got to try it all, and which I later learned was really dumb. And I learned how my drinking was to go from that point, because, well, the first thing that happened that I remember is I went in the bathroom before I threw up and passed out, which was almost always ended up for me, but I went in the bathroom, and I looked in the mirror, and I remember saying out loud to myself, "This is how I want to feel." It was the first time in my life that I had ever filled up that hole that I had inside me. Didn't know I had a hole inside me. It had never been filled before. It was always empty. And it was the first time in my life that hole was filled. And I thought, oh my God, my feet are on the ground. I just felt like I was part of the universe, and I couldn't wait to do it again. Now, prior to that, a year was my first year in public school. And they had drug education and all that stuff that they do, which I knew nothing about. And they had these people come in, and they told us what it meant to be, they talked about it, I guess. They talked about alcoholism, I don't know. I just remember going home and telling my mother, who was a drunk, and I was not going to be like her, that those people said that you don't even have to drink every day to be an alcoholic, that you can just drink sometimes and still be an alcoholic. Even if it's just on weekends, you can still be an alcoholic, because I was never going to be like her. Yeah. Like 2 years later, I'm drinking every weekend, and my amazing alcoholic mind says, yeah, but you have to drink in the morning. Yeah, but you have to this. And every time I stepped one more bar down, my mind just adjusted. My mind just said, yeah, but. And I just pushed that to the side, and it amazes me. And I got to tell you, I'm so touched by, I so much would rather be hearing from Esperanza and Pete and Barbara tonight, but I'm so touched by what you all said because it's so true. My mother, who I never wanted to be like, she just started chemotherapy last week. And one of you got up and said something about being the daughter that you, you know, get to be. And I get to be that daughter today. I put those people through hell. I put them through hell. The closest they ever got to being divorced was because of me. Because of me. And I get to take her to chemo, and I get to be there, and I get to do that stuff. Now, when I got sober, if you had told me that would be something I'd be excited to get to do, I wouldn't have been too interested. But it's such a privilege today. It's such a privilege. And it sucks that she has to go through it. It sucks, but it's going to suck either way. My old sponsor, Jan, before she died, used to always say, Suze, it's going to be how it's going to be. How are you going to be? And I thought, okay, so she's going to go through chemo either way. I can be a great daughter and help her through it or not. So my drinking career is really not that interesting. I got in a lot of trouble. I lived in Iowa, and I don't have any great DUI or jail stories, so sorry. But Iowa, we lived kind of out in the country, and you should never do this, but at that time, I'm sure they don't do it anymore, when I was 14, they allowed me to drive to school. So I had a car at 14. So at 14, you can only imagine, right? I'm picking up all my friends. We're drinking all the way to, I mean, it was bad. And so anyway, I'm very blessed that I didn't kill somebody because I drank and drove every day. And I look at my, I have a 14-year-old now, and I look at her and I think she has no idea. I had no idea. I had no idea I was driving a 2,000-pound weapon around. So I drank. I could not get enough drinking, and pretty soon alcohol didn't work for me, and I started adding things to the mix to try to get that feeling back. You know that feeling when you're one with the world and that hole's filled up, and there, you know, I got to the point where there was nothing that I could take or do that would fill up that hole. And I got to the point where I would take or do anything you told me that would make me feel different. And that got me in some pretty stupid predicaments because there's certain things you just should not take or do. But I would take it and then ask questions later. So, but that baby that I told you about at the beginning of the meeting, my last year of my drinking, my girlfriend worked at this arcade during the day, and I worked there at night. This is when they had arcades in malls. Like, because she didn't have video games at home. We just had Atari ping pong. And so people would go to the mall and play in the arcade, and she worked during the day, and I worked at night, so I would watch her baby all day while she worked. And I would go drive to her house, and I don't even know if I was supposed to be doing it at that time, but I was even old enough. And I would pick her up, and sometimes her husband would be beating her, and we'd climb out the window, and it was just normal. It was just normal. And we'd get the baby in the car, and I'd drop her off at work, and she would say to me, now, if you're going to do anything besides drink, you have to put the baby in the other room. This is the life I lived. That made perfect sense. As a parent today, it mortifies me. But we would just put the baby in the other room and do what we were going to do, and that was normal to me. And it just amazes me the mind's capacity to accept what's normal. Because I didn't have any other option. What else was I going to do? Really take a look at it? Take a long, hard look at what I was doing, drinking and driving with this baby in the car every single day? The reality of that is overwhelming. I was powerless. I had no other option. I could not live sober. I could not wake up and take a drink. So she would do that during the day, and then I would work at nighttime. And anyway, I don't know what happened to make me have that moment of clarity that Pete talked about where you looked in the mirror. But I do know that every single person that's sitting in this room has a chance to be a big book that somebody might see one day. And I knew a girl that drank and partied with us, and she disappeared. And she came back, and I heard the whisperings that she wasn't doing it anymore. And I called her one day. And I don't know why I called her. I don't know what happened. But she said, I can't help you. She said, but I know someone that can. And she called somebody, and they took me to an AA meeting, which was the last thing I wanted to go to. There had been some other cooler option to quitting drinking. And so I went to this AA meeting, and I went to a few AA meetings, but I could not put the drink down. And eventually went away to a treatment center. And the treatment center was based on the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, which I'm really glad they were, because the best thing they did was bring us AA meetings. And they had a young people's meeting every Thursday night, and there was probably about 100 people there. And I really did think my life was over, because if I couldn't drink anymore, what else was there? And so at least that does mean there was a lot of people my age, a lot of younger people. They appeared to be having a good time. And so it gave me a little bit of hope. So I'm really grateful for that. But you couldn't get out of there without doing a four-step inventory. So I don't know if any of you have gone to the fourth step, but those of you that have, it's an inventory looking at your life. And the book says, you know, it's a fact-facing and fact-finding mission. And I have found today sometimes that as a sponsor, it's my job to help somebody find the facts, and sometimes it's my job to help them face the facts. But I wasn't ready to face or find any facts when I was in that treatment center. And I'm sure they gave us a book or did something. I have no idea. But I just know I had to meet with this woman on a Sunday morning, and I had to get the thing done. So the directions in the book, they have these really nice columns in there. So I wrote the columns of so-and-so did this, and this is why I'm resentful. And I had some stuff happen to me when I was a kid. I mean, stuff that you wouldn't wish on a child. So I had all this stuff down there. I really wore the V really good. I was a really good victim. And I met with this woman on a Sunday morning. Now, mind you, I never turned the page in the book to finish the directions. I only had the three columns about who they were, what they did, and how it affected me. And I had a lot of fun writing that inventory. And I really didn't know what the big deal was and why people didn't want to do their fourth step. Because it really wasn't bad at all. I quite enjoyed it. Telling you one more time, if you had my life, you would have drank too. So I sat down with this woman, and we did the inventory, and I'm really lucky I survived, because I'm sure she was a volunteer, and I'm sure she was somebody coming out of the community meeting well. But when I told her everything I had on that paper, she said to me, music to my ears, she said, "You poor thing. You poor thing." And I thought, boy, she is right. I have had it rough. I have had it rough. And I walked out of there, and I felt really elated. And I've heard people talk about feeling elated after doing their fifth step, but I didn't realize I was elated because somebody had just validated that I really was a victim, and that if they had happened, you know, all that stuff. So I left that treatment center thinking I had done a fourth and fifth step. And I share that because that is not the directions in the book, and that is not a fourth or fifth step. And I don't ever need, ever, no matter what has gone on with me, need somebody to tell me, "You poor thing." I can do that all by myself. I need you guys to save my butt and tell me the truth. That is why I come here, and it's why I have a sponsor, and it's why I have surround myself in my life with people who aren't afraid to tell me the truth, because I don't need to hear anything else but that. So anyway, I got out of there, and I started going to meetings, and we had this crowd of us that ran together. And again, the people that spoke before me, I loved what you said, because I thought that us going to meetings and us going for coffee was Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought that was the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought you come in here, and again, I told you that if I could just stop drinking long enough, my life's going to be okay. So if I really believe that, what do I really need all that other stuff for? Because all those other steps are really for you screwed up people who really have problems. But my problem is just that I drink too much. And if I stop drinking, my problems are going to go away. Well, I found out what it means to really be an alcoholic. A real alcoholic like me, and like it talks about in the big book, my problems begin when I stop drinking. Because anybody can stop drinking, but staying stopped is a whole other story. And I could not live without my answer. And my answer was a drink. Alcohol was my solution. It wasn't my problem. It was my answer. So I came to AA for 2 years, and we went to a lot of coffee. And we went to a lot of meetings, and I was the person that you all prayed for a lot, I'm sure, because I would go to this club. I can still remember it, and I would sit there, and they would ask for a topic, because I only went to open discussion meetings. because I don't want to hear any of that other stuff. I don't want to hear about the book. I don't want to hear about the traditions. I don't want to hear. I just went to open discussion meetings where I could talk about my problems. So I would raise my hand for a topic all the time. And then I would get up and leave because I really didn't need anything y'all had to say. So, I mean, I just was a... I can remember people talking to me about my language. This woman tried to help me, and she brought me into someone's home. They had a big book study. They were studying the big book line by line. And I remember her. It was so uncomfortable in the car before we went into the house. And I'm thinking, why is she telling me this? Now, Suzanne, we are going into someone's home. It's very important. And she went through this list of things, like the F word, and some of these other things that just, I mean, that was just part of who I was. And I was very offended. And I also could not wait to get out of there, too. I'm like, oh, my God, these people are sitting in someone's house reading this book line by line. My life really is over. So, anyway... We didn't last too long together. God bless her. She tried to help me, but I was not willing. What has happened for me in my sobriety and what has changed my life is being willing to do things that I don't want to do, that I don't think are going to work, and that make me uncomfortable. That is what has helped me. And at that point in time, I was willing to do none of that. None of it. I was willing to go to meetings and go to coffee and eat a lot of pie and smoke a lot of cigarettes, but I was not willing to change anything in my life. And I was still living complete insanity. My first 2 years, I was in two more treatment centers for other stuff. I was in the intensive care unit, and I was in a psych ward in 2 years. That's pretty good, right? Sober. And somewhere in the second year, as I was in the psych ward with my big book, I had my big book, somebody looked at me and said, Suzanne, you haven't had a drink for like 2 years. And you think maybe just, you know, alcohol is your problem? And for some reason, I started to hear something a little bit different. I'm knocking stuff off. Hold on. So I get a little excited. But anyway, so around that time, I moved to Florida. And I had heard you all talking about this relationship with this God. And I told you about my God. So I didn't do God. For the first 2 years I was in AA, I did the group because I figured all of you put together, if you tried really hard, might be smarter than me. But my ego was so big that I couldn't even fathom the fact that you all could know something that I wouldn't know. But I'd heard you talk about there's going to come some point in time where if I don't have this spiritual defense, I'm going to take a drink. And I moved down here and I got scared. And I thought, okay, well, I didn't get a sponsor, I didn't get a home group or any of those wise things, but I decided I'd go back to church. So I went back to church, and I went to church for, I think, probably like 4 or 5 weeks, and I went to this really nice Catholic church, and by the fourth or fifth week, I was completely insane. Completely insane. And I had a list of all the things that they were doing during the Mass that upset me. It was quite a list. And I do not know, I honestly think it's the first time since I asked for help at that treatment center, that I asked for help. And I called up the church, God knows why, and I evidently made an appointment with somebody. I don't remember doing any of that. I just remember sitting across the desk from this Catholic priest, and he said, what can I do for you? And I burst into tears, and I said, I'm a recovering alcoholic, and I've been coming to the church, and these are all the things that are you doing to upset me. And I told him everything, told him all of it. And he listened, and then he said to me, do you have a sponsor? So anyway, what I've learned from that experience is that even if I screw up, as long as I'm moving forward and trying, that God will continue to offer me these opportunities for help, for the answer, if I keep trying, even if I'm crazy trying, which I was crazy. So around that time, I had started college, and I was going to school over at USF, and I went to a meeting one day, and this woman asked, she spoke, and I didn't know anything about home group or sponsorship, or if you had asked me what is an AA group, or if I'd ever read that pamphlet. I mean, I had no idea about, and it was foreign to me, and she spoke, and I really liked what she had to say, and I asked her after the meeting if she would sponsor me, and she said she would, and I remember talking to her a little bit, and at some point in time in that relationship in the first month, she said to me, now, have you done your steps? Have you, you know, done? I think she asked me about the eighth and ninth or how far I'd gone or whatever. And I said, yeah, I'm good. I did them all. So, and I honestly don't even think I knew I was lying. I really think I thought I was telling the truth. But I really, I mean, to me, I had stopped drinking. I had done whatever they told me to do in that treatment center. I had told my family I was sorry, right? So I'm good, I thought. So anyway, I was at her house one day, and the phone rang. And now, mind you, I have some time now. I have a couple years in the program. I have never read the big book. I have never read that book. I could care less about what some doctor had an opinion about. And some stockbroker from New York, I have no, you know, I mean, I had never opened the book. The only thing, that's not true. That's a lie. Because I had a book, and everybody highlighted 449, which is now 417, right? Is that right? Which is the acceptance paragraph. So everybody kept telling me to read that paragraph. And what that paragraph said to me is acceptance is the answer to all my problems today. So I have to accept this and accept that and whatever. So I went through life trying to accept all of you who I couldn't stand and my family who I couldn't stand. And I mean, I was absolutely homicidal and suicidal because I thought that's what it meant to accept it. What I've learned it means is that through the inventory process, I get freedom by finding out what's disturbed in me, and therefore I can accept me and I can accept you, and we're all one and it's all good, and I don't even have to try. I don't even have to try to not hate you. I did hate you. But anyway, so that was all I had read in the big book. And somebody called her on the phone, and they asked her if they could drink NA beer. And this is the first time I'd ever even heard of NA beer, because I never drank that. If I was going to drink, I was going to drink. And I heard her explain to them about the physical allergy, and that if you're an alcoholic and you really have this physical allergy, NA beer does have alcohol in it, and if you drink it, you could trigger that allergy and blah, blah, blah. And I was just amazed. Like, where did she get this stuff? It was amazing. But that was my first anything with the big book. With a couple years of sobriety, it was my first anything. And the reason I bring that up is because that, for me, sitting in her living room, hearing this happen, and she had just had a baby, and it was such a neat thing to see her and her sober husband together, even though I hadn't done any of the work myself, just being around it, and she changed my life. And she changed my life. And a couple years later, I went back and saw her, and her little girl was like 3 or 4 running around, and we visited, and it was so nice, and we went in the kitchen, and she popped open an NA beer and asked me if I wanted one. And this disease is cunning, baffling, and powerful. And exactly what she did was no different than my alcoholic mind that said, oh, you have to drink every day. Oh, you have to drink in the mornings. It's no different. And what scares the heck out of me and the reason that I always try to come here and stay here and be with you all is that I don't know when it's happening. If I had the power to know that it was happening, I had the power to change it. But I don't have that power. I need you all to say, hey, Sue, that sounds a little bit off base. Let's talk about that. I mean, I need other people in my life who are honestly taking a look at me, because if I'm going to grade it myself, as my now sponsor says all the time, I'm not going to give myself anything less than an A-, because I'm doing pretty good. So she, on the other hand, starts a lot of conversations with me with the phrase, let me offer this for your consideration. And that's when I know it's coming, but that's okay. So, long story short, because it is a long story, but I eventually did finally really get a sponsor, and I eventually did sit at somebody's kitchen counter, and I read through that book. And my ego by this time, because I hadn't had a drink, and look what I had done, and I had not only finished high school, I'd gone to college, I'd worked full time, I was paying my bills, I was doing all this stuff. And my ego was still vested, and I got this woman for a sponsor who did not have a college education, which is really irrelevant, but it was relevant for my ego. Because she asked me to read, like the first thing she asked me to read was the doctor's opinion, and she asked me to look up any words I didn't know. Well, I'm a college graduate. So I read I don't even know if I read the assignment. I probably didn't read the assignment. I sat at her kitchen counter, and we're reading that paragraph that says, drinks they see others taking with impunity. I'll never forget it. She passed away, by the way, and oh my God, she changed my life. That was Mary, Virginia. And she said, so what does impunity mean? And it was the first time in my life I went, I don't know. Because I never told you, I didn't know anything. I never let on that I wasn't good. I never told the truth. And I didn't even know I was a liar. I just lied by omission, I guess. But anyway, so she absolutely changed my life. I did a real inventory. And I did real amends. And I did real work. And I found out that I am just as powerless over my character defects as I am over picking up a drink, and I can wish to be a good girlfriend, and I could wish to be a good employee, and I can will all those things with all my might, but I don't have the power. I don't have the power, but if I follow the simple directions in this book, that power flows through me. And that's an amazing thing, because I am completely incapable of doing the things that I have done in the last 30-plus years. I'm completely incapable, but oh my gosh, I have done a lot of things in the last 30-plus years. It has been an amazing ride. I'd like to share another thing. You know, that woman took me through the steps, and I got involved in service, and I became an alternate GSR and a GSR, and I got to learn about what it really meant to be a member of AA and to do those things, and it was amazing. And I got to the point where I went from hating you all and going to the meeting to check it off my list to where I couldn't wait to get to my home group. And if you're not at your home group, they all want to know where you're at. That's an amazing thing. It's an amazing thing to have that. And we decided to move to Naples. We lived in Palm Harbor. And I was a little bit scared about moving, but my sponsor pointed out to me that I would have AA wherever I went. So I really just had to go with what was better for my husband. I mean, not that it would be bad for me, but we were kind of back and forth. Did we stay here? Did we go there? And I thought, I will never find a home group like I have. It'll never happen. And I moved to Naples, and I started going to this meeting every day. And now I have a lot of time by now, which for me was a lot of time. I'm in double digits. And I'm married, by the way. Did I mention that? I got married. And we got married the year before we moved to Naples. And I get down there, I'm going to these meetings every day, and I've been there about a month, and for a month I am raising my hand, I'm new to the group, I'm new to the area, putting my hand out, doing all the things I'm told you're supposed to do. I got a service position, I got a home group, and I am still feeling all alone. And I sat down and you know, with double-digit sobriety next to a woman one day, and she was one of the happiest people I've ever met in my life. She'd always say, doesn't it just make you want to dance? And I said, Jan, I said, I've been coming to this meeting five nights a week after work on my way home, and I still don't feel like I'm a part of anything. And she said, why don't you come sit with us? And she was my sponsor for the next 12 years. And she died of cancer a couple years ago. And to watch her walk through that with dignity and grace, I still hear her all the time in meetings. I hear her. Some of the things she said and some of the things she did. But the reason that's relevant is because, you know, I mentioned I got married. I would not be married today if it weren't for that sponsor relationship, because I am incapable of forming a partnership with another human being. I'm incapable, because all I can see is myself, my needs, my wants, my desires, what I want. I'm incapable of thinking about you. I don't know if I was genetically inbred this way, or, you know, it's my upbringing, or a piece got left out that I have no idea, but it's so foreign to me. And we moved down to Naples, and I got Jan as my sponsor, and we're down there about a year, and he pissed me off one more time, that's how I lived. I didn't know you could live and not be PO'd all the time. I thought that was normal. I thought that he would make me mad, I would make him pay. That was our relationship. And he's a great guy. I mean, many of you have met him. He's a wonderful guy. I don't know how he survived me, but anyway, I can remember we had horses, which was my dream. And one day he had gone to buy the wrong horse food or something. And, you know, he didn't know anything about it. He just wanted to know where the on-off button was on the horse. He knew nothing. And the guy drove. We lived 45 minutes from nowhere. And he drove to get the feed. And he either didn't buy the food or bought the wrong one. I don't remember. All I know is we had 10 acres. And I am in the middle of the 10 acres, purple, with my double-digit sobriety, screaming at the top of my lungs at this idiot who can't do anything right. And I remember after I got done screaming, I remember looking over at my neighbor's house, wondering if they were outside or not. And my next thought was, I wonder if only my home group could see me now, you know. But if it weren't for sponsorship, I would not be married today. I would not, because it was all his fault. And when he made me mad that one more time, what my head said was, that's it, I'm out of here. I'm out of here. And I didn't even know that I had been saying that for 3 years. Every time that we had a disagreement, every time something happened, I would just say, that's it, I'm out of here. And I didn't even know I was doing it. And after a year, I got mad, I did it one day, and my next thought was, holy crap, I'm married. I can't just leave. You know, I could have just left, but I didn't want to just leave. I mean, I really meant that vow when I said it. And I did some very painful inventory work. It was not pain, it's probably very painful for my sponsor, but it was painful because I had to be willing to discard all these ideas that I had lived with my entire life that I was so sure were right because I made them up and they came from me, so they must be right. And I had to be willing to consider someone else's conception of what it meant to be a partner in a relationship, or what it meant to be loving in a relationship. And I had to be willing to discard all of those, and I'm so grateful, because if I had left him at that point in time, I would have worn that D on my head one more time. I would have been justified to be a victim about what a jerk he was. I would have missed the three children that I have now. I would have missed so many things that I have in my life, which is a whole other story. But I got to tell you, when we set our vows, he really didn't want to have children. And the vow was, I will lovingly accept any children that God gives to me. And you can see in the video him looking at me, because he goes, you know I'm going to be lying when I say yes to that. And I said, yeah, I know. So so I got pregnant in sobriety, and I was scared to death. I was scared to death. And I remember at work they would have baby showers and they would do things and people would be like, oh, don't you want to come see the baby clothes? I'd be like, no, not really. Because my only experience is what I shared with you. That was my experience with children. It was not a good experience. I mean, I could have told you a lot more other stories. I mean, none of them were rosy, peachy, can't wait to have that maternal instinct, you know, loving mother thing. My mother was, you know, the one thing she says today, if she could have done anything different, she would have hit me a lot less. I mean, it was not, my parents loved me, but she didn't have any other way to cope either, you know. So, I mean, being a parent was not really that enticing to me. And I can remember saying to Jan, you know, what am I going to do? When this baby comes out, what am I going to do? And she kept saying, Suze, just trust God. It's going to be okay. And so many of you guys know that we have had so many little people through our house. Not only do I have one going, a senior this year, a 14-year-old. We have a 8-year-old that we adopted, which is a good thing, because if she'd been first, we would have had no other ones. And we had so many other little people come through our home in the process. And I want to share that, because we started doing foster care, because when I thought if I had had these kids when I was drinking, I would have wanted somebody loving them while I was trying to get my life together. So that was our motive in doing that. And boy, was it an interesting ride for 10 years. But I do want to share that last weekend, we had two boys, who a couple of you might have met, come stay with us. And they lived with us 9 years ago for almost 2 years. And they spent the weekend with us. They live in New York now. God, it just felt like everything just came full circle. It felt like they were just there yesterday. And yet it was a long, long time ago. And they're miracles. They're miracles. And we were able to have some really hard conversations. Stuff that kids think about that you would have never thought. But anyway, the point is, I would have missed all of that. I would have missed everything if I had only thought about what I thought about and not been willing to follow the directions in this book. You know, so I love that line at the beginning of the 12 and 12, because I don't want to just be sober. I want to live a life that's useful. I want to live a life that's fun. I want to live a life that I look forward to getting up in the morning and going to bed at night. And the last thing I want to say is about sponsorship, because not only has it changed my life, but sponsoring women in this program has changed my life. And I didn't sponsor for a long time, and I think it's because I really didn't have anything to offer for a really long time. I mean, nobody really wanted what I had. Walking through these steps with another woman has been a life-changing experience. And seeing their lives change and seeing the miracle happen in their life. And the great thing about being a sponsor is I can't ask you to do something that I'm not willing to do. I can't ask you to do something that I'm not willing to do. So being a sponsor makes me really accountable. And I got to tell you, the last couple years, we have walked through some stuff, man. We have buried children. We have gone through bankruptcies and divorces and infidelities and cancers and job losses and parents dying and caregivers and, you know, all this stuff that's life. It's life. And if I'm not sober, I don't get to suit up and show up for any of that. I get to go drink and hide in the closet, throw up and pass out because that's my MO. And I don't get to be there. And when the rubber meets the road, well, where was Suzanne? Oh, she's over there doing what she does. And I haven't had to do any of that because I've been able to be present. And watching these women, I have so much admiration for watching these women walk through the stuff that they've walked through and stay sober. And they keep me sober. I must be really sick because I need to be really involved in this thing. I have to, like it was shared before the meeting, I can't just come to my one or two meetings a week and go home. This is a way of life for me. And I have to do all of it. You know, I have to have the sponsor, I have to sponsor, I have to have the service commitments, I have to pray, I have to exercise, which I used to hate, but I actually enjoy now. I mean, I have to do all these things to take care of myself. And I'm really grateful, for the opportunity to be here. And congratulations on, we had a lot of people with 30 days and 60 days. And, at 30 and 60 days, I really wasn't sure if I was in or I was out. So I want to tell you that if you can hang on, and maybe try and do some of the things that has been suggested, like get that home group so people know where you're at and when you're going to be there. Get that service commitment, even though you're scared to death of what the heck it might be or what they might ask you to do. You know, open up that big book and ask somebody to take you through it. I don't really understand what they're talking about here, and that's where the miracle happens. So I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.